Welcome to Willoughby Hills. I'm Heath Rosella. Thank you for being here. It's my podcast. Happy to have you for another new episode. Dennis Kucinich is my guest today. Dennis was a U.S. representative for the state of Ohio from 1997 to 2013. Also served as an Ohio state senator. He was mayor of Cleveland. And he is now an independent candidate running for Ohio's 7th congressional district. We're going to dive into a lot today. Before we get to the interview, I am sounding a little funny. It's a little strange. My house is up for sale. We are just waiting to close. We have an offer on it. And the attic where I have been recording these podcasts for the last 4 years now is nearly empty. So you might not be able to hear it, especially if you're like in the car or something, but I sound weird and echoey and empty, and just this room is not what it usually was. And yeah, it's a different vibe, but it won't be long before I will be coming to you from my new podcast studio at the new house. So I was very excited for this conversation with Dennis today. I have called out his Substack a couple of times in my newsletter because he has been one of the few people in the U.S. political world that is willing to call a spade with what is happening in Palestine right now. Almost from the beginning, since October 7th, he has been saying, hold on, what's going on here? Why are we funding this genocide of the Palestinian people? Why are we supplying weapons to Israel? Why are we standing by against international law and watching 40,000 Palestinians get slaughtered? And again, he has been one of the only people I have seen saying this, which kind of boggles my mind. I mean, I've seen these videos, and I'll talk about it with Dennis today, where people are going up to their representatives and saying, hey, are you going to do anything about the slaughter of Palestinians? And these representatives from both parties are completely willing to defend what Israel is doing, are completely unable to see Palestinians as human or worth defending in any way, and seem content to not be involved in any way. So I wanted to understand, why is Dennis speaking out in this moment? What is it that he sees that other politicians don't see? And also, how does he tie the issues in Palestine to issues in the United States? His district, and you know, Ohio in general, is a very kind of working class, blue collar state, very meat and potatoes, Midwest. It's not the place where you go for policies on international diplomacy. It's a place where people care about jobs and taxes and things like that. But Dennis has been at the forefront of saying, hey, you should care about Palestine too. So I wanted to understand, where does that come from? How does that work? So we're going to get a lot today into Gaza, into Palestine, into Israel, and all of those politics. I will say there is one thing that I wish I had done differently. We recorded this interview on May 1st, and that was the day after the NYPD had raided Hamilton Hall at Columbia, and there were other acts of violence happening at other campuses across the country. Obviously, that violence has just continued to escalate, and we're seeing more and more of these Gaza solidarity encampments at campuses across the country, but also a bigger police crackdown. So anyways, that's the context of this conversation. This was recorded on May 1st. I'm recording this intro right now on May 7th. So I've had a little bit of time to digest what we talked about and to think back on it. One thing that I wish I had done differently is Dennis and I were so aligned on 90% of these issues around Palestine. The one thing that he says in here that I let go unchallenged, I didn't question, I didn't ask follow-ups about, is he mentions that he feels like Israel has the right to exist. You will hear this come up, and it's in the context of trying to make a broader point. I felt like he was leading somewhere. I wanted to see where he was going to go with his point, but it definitely bumped me in the moment, and it's something that I wish I had handled a little differently. For me, a statement like Israel has the right to exist 6-7 months ago would have been a no-brainer. I didn't know the history. I didn't know anything about what was going on over there. And it's like, yeah, you know, nobody should be attacked for who they are. Israel, as I understood it at the time, was supposed to be a safe haven for Jewish people. Now, as I've learned more about it, I've learned that so much of my understanding of that region, and again, it was minimal before October 7th, was simply not true and was based in U.S. war propaganda. If you go back to the founding of Israel in 1948, thousands of Palestinians had to flee from their homes, their native lands where they had lived for generations. Many, many were killed, and the state of Israel was established on this land that had been Palestine. And as you look over time, the territory that is under Israel continues to grow, and the territory that is considered Palestine, which is recognized by many countries, not recognized by the U.S., continues to shrink year after year. And we are seeing that play out. I mean, again, I'm recording this on May 7th. The Rafah crossing was just destroyed by the Israeli army. The people that have fled to Rafah because it was supposed to be a safe haven are now being bombed with nowhere to go. They're being told to flee with nowhere safe to go within Gaza. There is this history of violence against the native Palestinian people. And that is something that I just did not understand 6 or 7 months ago that I do today. On top of that, I think there is confusion by people conflating Israel and Judaism. If Israel doesn't exist, the Jewish faith cannot exist. If Israel is not safe, Jews all around the world are not safe. Now, I don't buy into that thinking. I think, you know, Jewish people, Muslims, Christians, atheists, agnostics, whatever, should be safe any and everywhere. And it's our job as humans to make that safe space for each other. And when Dennis said Israel has the right to exist, I didn't think I was going to change his mind in that moment. And I felt like it could be a distraction from the rest of the conversation. It could be a rabbit hole that we went down and, you know, spent 20 minutes debating back and forth and maybe didn't get to other topics. So again, I let it go. I let him say his opinion. I didn't challenge it. And now, just having sat on it for 6 or 7 days, I wish I had asked a question, partially for myself, just to say, hey, I'm not aligned with what you're saying. Partially to understand his opinion. I'm not saying I'm 100% right. There's a chance that there's something that he's saying that might be valid, or, you know, he might have a reason for feeling the way he does. Maybe I would have learned something if I would have asked. Or maybe in questioning it, he would have had to question his own assumptions. Maybe nobody has ever asked him, why do you think Israel should exist? And if he had to confront that, maybe he would change. Or not. I don't know. But I know that I let that moment pass. And it's something you hear in here. I wanted to preface it because I've been sitting on it for a week or so and just thinking harder about how would I do it differently next time. So there's that. I'm fascinated in Dennis, too, because he has been a progressive voice for a long time. I don't know him well. I think I've met him once or twice. One was at a campaign event, actually, when he was running for president and came through Massachusetts back in 04. But he knows my family, and we're going to dive into that at the end of this conversation as well. He was very good friends and still is very good friends with one of my uncles growing up, and spent a lot of time in my dad's childhood home. My dad is one of 12 kids. Dennis knew the siblings. He knew my grandparents well. My grandfather, who was an immigrant from the Philippines, I never knew him. He died about 20 years, a little less than 20 years, maybe 17 years before I was born, something like that. I don't have a sense of him beyond some photographs that I have and the stories that my dad and his siblings have told me. I've never heard an outside perspective on what he was like. I've never heard from somebody else in the house who wasn't part of the family give their take on my grandfather. So that was really meaningful to get to ask him just about my own family and what it meant growing up on the Near West Side with my dad and his siblings back in the day. So we get a little of that at the end of this conversation as well. But given everything that is happening in the world right now, Gaza certainly is top of mind. That is the thrust of this conversation. If you enjoy this podcast, I know I say it every episode, but just a reminder, I do have a newsletter that I publish twice a week, every Wednesday and every Sunday. You can go to heathrasala.com/newsletter to get on the list there. And if you like what I'm doing here with this podcast, with the newsletter, if you're learning things, if you're growing, if you're changing, if you are seeing the world differently, please consider a paying subscription as well. It helps support the work that I do here, helps keep this podcast running, and it helps you just say, hey, I like what you're doing. Keep it up. HeathRasala.com/newsletter. All right, here it is, my conversation with Dennis Kucinich. So, Dennis, I want to start with just sort of where we are and checking our pulse, I guess, on the last, even just 24 hours has been kind of crazy. We've seen New York police officers storm Columbia, Zionists attack the encampment at UCLA, protesters clashing with police at the University of Madison in Wisconsin. You wrote a recent piece called American Spring, talking about freedom of speech, and I think alluding to the Arab Spring with that title. What is your take on sort of the current protest movement and what's happening on college campuses across the country?
Well, as young Americans are awakening to the moment that we're in, which is one where endless war, genocide, ethnic cleansing, continual funding of wars through our government, building up further a military-industrial complex, which now commands at least $1 trillion of our annual budget.
Yeah.
So young people are looking at this and they're going, hey, wait a minute. Why am I struggling trying to make ends meet to have a college career? And our nation is just going in an opposite direction. 56% at this moment of the discretionary budget of the United States goes for the Pentagon.
Wow.
And if you add the intelligence and all of that apparatus, you're probably looking at closer to 60%.
Wow.
So, you know, young people need to be heard from. There's still a First Amendment, and we ought to use it.
Yeah. I mean, you have been one of the handful of politicians from the beginning, really, calling out what's happening in Palestine, being fairly pro-Palestine with your stances. I'm curious, like, it seems to be on both sides of the aisle that people are afraid to speak out against Israel. You have been in Congress for a long time. Like, what do you think is going on there? Why are you one of the few politicians, and certainly one of the few white male politicians, willing to talk about this issue?
Well, look at it this way. Our society, our politics, and in some ways our world, is trapped into dichotomized thinking.
Uh-huh.
You have to think one way or you have to think another way.
Sure.
And there's no in between. Now, I think one can be concerned about the lives of Palestinians and Israelis at the same time. One can speak out against the murders of Israelis that were committed on October 7th and the murders that are being created against the Palestinians.
Yeah.
Now, and that's what I do that.
Sure.
Because there are people out there who feel, well, you have to take one side or another. No, this is about the human race. This is about who are we as people?
Sure.
How can anybody see the slaughter that is going on and not feel it? Those who try to dehumanize any group are contributing to the degradation of our society and the demeaning of all life on the planet. And so my view is that wherever there are people who are suffering, wherever there are people who need a voice, wherever there are people who are unjustly being persecuted, who are being destroyed by war, I need to be the one that speaks out. I've done it throughout my entire career.
Sure.
And this time, what's happening in Gaza is horrific. It is a dedicated effort to chase Gazans out of their homeland, to use ethnic cleansing as an instrument to facilitate that, to use famine, starvation as a tool.
Yeah.
I mean, you could talk about whether international law is being enforced, and I know it's not. International law has been thrown out the window. But how about basic human decency? How about compassion? How about understanding that the lives of people in Gaza are just as important as the lives of people who live in Israel? They're not less than. Because the minute that we evoke someone as an outgroup, the minute we dehumanize people, that sets the stage for the worst kind of human conduct one could imagine.
Sure. But I guess you and I see that, and it's plain as day to you and I and to a lot of people watching this stuff, you know, on social media and things. I feel like there are so many people in Congress right now, the Senate and the House, that refuse to see that. 30,000 dead Palestinians plus, And I see these videos all the time of people walking up to their congressperson and saying, hey, are you going to vote against it? And the votes keep coming that, yes, let's give more military aid to Israel, to your initial point that, you know, 50%+ of our budget. Like, what do you do about that?
But think about this.
Sure.
Let's go back to a point I was making a moment ago.
Yeah.
Right now in Congress, there's only two ways of looking at the world, Democrat or Republican. Now, within each party, there are individuals who will try to take a different direction. There seems to be more people willing to do that in the Republican Party today. The problem is defective consciousness, which says that this is the world. It's between these barriers. It's either you're either a Democrat or Republican.
Right.
You could either think one way or the other. It's what I call dichotomized thinking.
Sure.
And dichotomized thinking means you're either for this or against that, and it creates enemies. It's us versus them, whoever they are, and it inevitably leads to war. So what I'm trying to do is say, hey, there's another way to look at this.
Yeah.
And I've always presented that during my public career. There's another way to look at things. This year, I'm running as an independent because I want to provide a different way for members of Congress to look at where we are at this moment. Because right now, you have the Democratic Party seemingly thoroughly dedicated to war, to an expansion of military-industrial complex, to the evisceration of our basic freedoms, like, you know, Fourth Amendment, freedom to be free of unreasonable search and seizure.
Yeah.
I present a different point of view, and the best way I can do it right now is as an independent candidate in Ohio's 7th Congressional District, and people want information, go to Kucinich.com. You want to help, we need help. Take our message directly to the streets, to door to door, to let people know there's another way. We don't have to be trapped into this endless spiral of war, which seems to be the kind of thinking that emanates from Washington. And I say it's time to challenge that. And one way to do it is to do what I'm doing.
Sure. And I want to ask you about running as an independent in a minute here, but just on this Israel-Palestine issue for another moment, like, I agree with you about the dichotomized thinking and sort of the tribalism and just it's my team, it's this team. But on this one issue, on the issue of funding military aid to Israel, there seems to be nearly unanimous support, or, you know, darn near closer than anything we've ever had to bipartisan agreement. It's on both sides of the aisle. And I'm just wondering how you break that and how you...
First of all, it doesn't reflect the feeling of the American people.
Agreed.
By any measurement. And how you break it is to have one person inside who says, wait a minute, we got to look at this another way. We can't, you know, does the Israel lobby have influence in Congress? Of course it does.
Sure.
I was never moved by any lobby. You know, once you get into the system which says, you know, here's how you get elected, this group's going to help you, that group's going to help you, and that's the only way you can win.
Yeah.
You know, some members are trapped in that. But you need at least one voice who can say, wait a minute, there's a bigger question going on here.
Sure.
And if you're for Israel, and you know, I certainly am one who feels that Israel must exist, okay? But the question that has to be asked, how does the survival of Israel square with the Israeli government's penchant for waging unrelenting, unremitting war against people who can't even defend themselves? How does that square? Isn't, you know, the ICC is quite possibly going to be indicting Mr. Netanyahu and a number of his people because their conduct has violated every principle of international law that is out there.
Sure.
Now, how does that serve Israel? How does it serve Israel to be an agent of destruction of innocent people who are just trying to live their life just like Israelis? I am against anything that happened to Israel that was aimed at destroying people because they're Jews or destroying them because they're Israeli. I oppose that kind of thinking. I never supported and never will. On the other hand, the crisis that faces us in the moment is the conduct of the Israeli government in prosecuting a genocide, an ethnic cleansing, inducing of famine and starvation. That's against every law of God and man. And so, you know, how do you stand up to that? You must be a voice. One must speak out. And when any one person who has any courage can help make a majority.
Yeah, I like that.
So, you know, if you don't participate and you speak out, sooner or later you can have people who gravitate you towards your point of view. But if you don't want to be, if you don't want the lobbies to control Washington, then don't take their money.
Yeah,
it's easy.
I mean, let me ask you this though: as a congressional candidate now, like so many politicians campaign on the idea of domestic policies, and I'm going to make your life better. I'm going to lower taxes. I'm going to, you know, help jobs, whatever. Talking so much about what's happening in Palestine, which to me is certainly top of mind right now. But I'm curious, just when you're out talking to voters, how do you get that message across that what happens there matters to people in Cleveland or elsewhere around the country?
It's very easy, actually. You know, since 9/11, the United States has spent close to $8 trillion for war, for either getting ready for war or for prosecuting war or for funding other countries that are in war.
Yeah.
We put all that on the national credit card. The national debt is now $34 trillion.
Yeah.
Now, for that $8 trillion, which, you know, goes to debt, that equals about $97,000 per American family of four.
Wow.
This is an economic issue which must be brought home.
Yeah.
People are struggling now in many places to make ends meet. The cost of food, the cost of fuel, energy, the cost of health care and education, the cost of housing, whether you rent or own. Everything's going up, up, up. Now, the government has an important role in that. Our priorities now are directed outward, changing events in other countries. Well, I'm sorry, but don't we have things to be concerned about back home? So, you know, this is where priorities are set. And when you consider that out of our discretionary budget of over $3 trillion annually, that are less than that, that the Pentagon, the intelligence agencies are getting 56% of it. Come on.
Yeah.
What are we talking about here? Have we just become a military machine under the guise of a nation? Or are we a nation with a military that can help defend us when we're under attack? But right now, we're not playing defense. We're playing offense, and we're perpetuating an offensive attack against people who cannot defend themselves, who we discover exist sometimes only after the fact when mass graves are dug up. I mean, what's happened to our country?
Yeah.
What's happened to our society that we can just avert our eyes when we see women and children, entire families wiped out only because they happen to be Arabs, Muslims?
Yeah.
Palestinians, Gazans. That's not right. It wasn't right when Hitler did it to the Jews, and it's not right when it's being done to the Palestinians right now, and it must stop.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. And I know, I mean, you have been fervently anti-war for a long, long time. I mean, running for president in 2004 on that platform when nobody else was talking about it. I mean, this has been your issue for a long time. And I guess I want to ask kind of that bigger question, too, of just we have been almost my entire lifetime at war with somebody or funding somebody else's war somewhere.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you talk about 56% of our discretionary spending. Like, how do you stop that when there is so much momentum, when there is so much national interest, when it's funding jobs and, you know, the economies of this country? How do you say we need to spend that elsewhere from a pragmatic standpoint, I guess?
Okay, well, you know, let's use a frame of reference that many people understand. It's from the Bible. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free.
Yep.
Okay? The truth is that after 9/11, our leaders lied about Iraq being involved in 9/11. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11.
Yeah.
I communicated a very detailed report, which anybody can get on the internet. Just type in Kucinich analysis of Iraq war resolution, October 2nd, 2002. Just type that in.
Sure.
And what you'll find out is back then, I pointed out to members of Congress and hand-delivered it to people inside the House of Representatives by the hundreds.
Yeah.
Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, with Al-Qaeda's role in 9/11. Iraq didn't have the potential, the capability of attacking America, didn't have the intention of attacking America, didn't have the weapons of mass destruction that were said to be ready to be employed against the United States.
Yeah.
This was all a fantastic, colossal lie, which I could see through.
Sure.
These eyes saw through the lies. And it was pushed by our government. The media picked it up. The media didn't ask questions. Now, I was able to organize 125 members of Congress to vote against the Iraq War resolution. You have to tell the truth and be ready to tell the truth, even if it might not be politically popular. How do you fight it? You tell the truth. And the truth is, the people who took us into Iraq lied, and some of them are still in charge of our policymaking.
Yeah.
And they're lying right now. And you know, they lied about a war in Libya, and we, you know, that conflict is still going on. They destroyed Iraq. Maybe a million innocent people lost their lives. 1 million.
Yeah.
Their lives, but for the war, would have continued.
Yeah.
Now, we have to ask ourselves, do we just move on? Is this like, well, okay, this isn't like golf. You miss a shot and you get a mulligan. You kill a million people, and there ought to be responsibility. I put in articles of impeachment against President Bush and Vice President Cheney for the lies that they told and in taking us into war. So frankly, you have to tell the truth. And that's why I want to go back to Congress. I'm a truth teller. Doesn't mean I'm never wrong, but the truth is the truth. And when you tell it and you don't have any interest, any interest that you're promoting,
sure,
but the interests of the common good and the people,
yeah,
there's a lot of power in that. So you make a difference by being willing to make a difference. Any one of us can make a difference. These students who are out there on campus right now, they're making a difference. They're communicating their concern, what they feel in their heart, and what they know needs to be said. Are they against Jews? No. Are they against Israelis? No. They're against a policy which is killing people. And those who want to keep the killing of people are smearing the college protesters, trying to say, well, hey, we know why you're doing this. You're staying in Hamas pup tents. What?
Yeah.
Come on. I mean, look, my approach is very blunt, very precise, and to the point. And we're talking about what could spiral into World War III.
Sure.
And we somehow think that, you know, these things can't happen. Well, I'm sure there were people during before World War I, who thought, oh, this will never happen.
Right.
And before World War II, who thought, well, this will never happen.
Right.
And I'm sorry, we have to keep our eyes open always to be vigilant for peace. And that's what I do.
Sure. I mean, that question, though, of truth, again, you have been this truth teller for a long time, and I think have been proven right in a lot of cases, sometimes many years after the fact. But there are lots of people that want to smear you in the moment or smear others that are telling the truth. And we live in this fractured media environment now with social media, with corporate media, where it's often hard to know, you know, somebody can be equally convincing that is full up gaslighting you to your face as they are that are, you know, telling the absolute truth. Like, for just an average voter that's out there trying to understand what's happening in the world and maybe can't point to Palestine or Iraq or, you know, whatever on a map, like, how it's a full-time job to try to figure out what's even happening around
it
you.
Is.
What advice do you have for people
Absolutely.
Who are trying to discover the truth?
You just have to sit down quietly and ask if things make sense. And if they don't look like they make sense, they don't.
Yeah.
I mean, why should the United States be furthering war against Russia if we don't want a World War III with Russia?
Yeah.
Why should the United States be paying for a war against the Palestinians if we don't want to see all these dead bodies piling up?
Yeah.
Why don't we, as a nation, stand for diplomacy? Why do our leaders lack the capability to be able to explore the science of human relations? Why, when our leaders see a nail, do they look for a hammer everywhere around the world? Why do we have 800 bases around the world? And more than, you know, no other country has that. China just has a few bases away from their mainland. Russia has one or two. Why? What have we become as a nation that this instinct to control other countries leads to massive expenditures of our tax dollars, which end up killing people, and we think we can do this with impunity as a nation? Oh, are you kidding? Yeah. I mean, we really have to think about these things. Now, look, Heath, I live in the same house I've lived in for 53 years in a working-class neighborhood in the city of Cleveland.
Yeah.
My sensibilities come from that community. It comes from the way I grew up. I see these things happening and I say, this is just horrible and it's stupid. And our leaders have to have better information and more options and not be corrupt.
Yeah.
And there's a combination of those things that come into play when votes are cast.
I want to ask you about that neighborhood a little bit, just because I am curious. Like, I know that before your district was kind of gerrymandered, and this is my read on it at least, but as a Clevelander most of my life, and you know, I've been gone for 20 some years now, but growing up there, you were a beloved figure and somebody who understood, you know, the working class neighborhoods in and around Cleveland, and you know, steel workers, auto workers, union guys. A lot of those people in the last 20 so years have shifted to, you know, you have always been very progressive, I would say, just looking at the political spectrum, irrespective of party. You've always been pretty left politically. And a lot of these people now are supporting right-wing candidates. Ohio has gone from, you know, purple to fairly red, I would say, from a governor's standpoint, presidentially. What do you think has changed with your electorate? And like, how does your message, I guess, as more of a progressive voice, still interface with these people that are now much more MAGA and Trump?
Well, my position is in the center of American politics. You know, that American eagle needs two wings to fly.
Yeah.
Left wing and a right wing. Also needs a head and a heart and a brain. I'm in the center of the American political experience right now. At another time, I may have been in a different direction, but right now I'm in the center. And because of that, I understand why people move from being Democrat to Republican in support of Donald Trump. You can easily go back to trade agreements that were passed under Democratic administrations, which resulted in a destructive undermining of our strategic industrial base of steel, automotive, aerospace, shipping,
sure,
and all the array of manufacturing that supported those industries.
Yeah.
That provided for tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of jobs in the greater area, northern Ohio and beyond, in the Midwest.
Sure.
So many of those jobs were lost. They were good paying jobs. They gave people a chance to have a decent home, to be able to afford health care or have health care if they were in a union, to be able to support their education of their children. I mean, it's kind of things that people, you know, are part of what we understood was the American dream. Decent wages, benefits. What happened? Those trade agreements, the NAFTA, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, the World Trade Organization enforcing things that are close to American sovereignty, the most favored nation status for China. All of those things moved our jobs out of this country, flooded America with cheap goods, undermined American economy. And then what happens? Then you get the next evolution, which is the Amazon approach towards crushing a lot of small businesses.
Sure.
By making these cheap goods available and delivering them to people's doors. So there's a lot of angry people out there. There's a lot of people who are having trouble making ends meet. There's a lot of people who wanted to retire earlier and they can't because they have to keep working.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who feel that everything they worked their life for is slipping away. Okay, and they're right. And that's what goes back to what are our national priorities. We're spending money out of sight on war.
Yeah.
So Donald Trump arrives, and look, I'm not for Trump. I'm not for Biden. I'm for the people. I'm running as an independent to be their voice in Congress, not the voice of a Democratic administration, a Republican administration. I'm putting country above party, okay?
Yeah.
But people were upset with the direction which Democratic administrations, particularly starting with Clinton, took the economy.
Yeah.
And that was a rebellion. It wasn't that they were in love with Donald Trump. They were just fed up with getting sold out. And, you know, they're getting sold out again by this tremendous amount of money, this tremendous amount of money that's being spent for war right now. And I think most Americans agree with me on this, that America has to start taking care of things here at home and quit roaming the world looking for dragons to slay. We were warned about that by our founders, and, you know, we forgot about it.
Yeah. And by several, I mean, Eisenhower talked about it. It's been a through line in American history there. You've mentioned this independent run. Can you just talk to me a little bit about that and just why now, and why did you decide to not be part of a party at this point?
Well, I've never been into groupthink, Heath.
Yeah.
You know, no one's ever come up to me and said, well, this is what the party thinks, and so you better get in line. I don't think that way. I don't do anything that way. Nobody can tell me, well, this is the way others are doing it, so you have to go along. No, I've always been independent in my thinking. Have I aligned at times with Democrats? Yeah. But we're at a moment in our country's history where it is urgent to have an independent voice. And when you think about it, how closely divided the Congress is right now, imagine what it'll be like if there's 217 Democrats, 217 Republicans, and one independent. I mean, I can really, it's not just a strong voice for a district, but a strong independent voice for all Americans who want to make sure there's another way of looking at things, that somebody can be a voice for that, that somebody who is tried and tested and unafraid to speak out, to challenge the status quo at any moment. And I think, you know, I think there's a space for that in American politics. Now, the practicalities are this. Some people will remember that my last time in Congress, I was redistricted out of my seat.
Yep.
My district was drawn to Toledo, and I ran against a popular incumbent as a result, and it was very difficult to win that election. There was no way I was going to win it at that point. And the Democrats in Columbus who drew the district knew that. I was redistricted out by Democrats, not by Republicans.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. Okay.
I mean, well, think about this. Does that not prove my independence? Does that not show that I'm not the life of the party, okay? That I'm willing to stand up and speak out, even in challenging my own party on matters of war, which I did.
Sure.
In challenging the Obama administration on its adventure into Libya, and in challenging them to get out of Afghanistan to do everything we can to use diplomacy. So I was redistricted out. I didn't have a place to run effectively after that. But surprise, surprise, the last redistricting that went into effect in 2023 included almost half of my old district, which I represented for 16 years.
Yeah.
So in Cuyahoga County. So I have a place to run. And I have a place where people know me. They know they can trust me. They know that I'm about public service, not just about giving speeches, that I'm about making government work for people. And I've proven that over a lifetime of service. So this election then becomes an opportunity for the voters of the 7th Congressional District to break free of party control, of the old thinking that locks people into only two choices.
Yeah. I mean, let me ask you this, though. Like, when you were mayor of Cleveland, you were the youngest mayor, I believe, ever to serve the city of Cleveland. You're now at a very different place in your life. And I think people your age often would be happy to, you know, sit on a beach and, you know, have a couple of drinks and whatever, like enjoy retirement. I still feel that passion in you clearly. And that is coming across loud and clear right now. But I am just curious, like, why now and why you in this moment?
Well, first of all, why now? Because our country is at a tipping point. you know, we could very easily slide into World War III based on the thinking of the people who are currently running the country.
Yeah.
There's not enough strong voices for peace and for solving things diplomatically. There's still this old thinking that leads us into war. And the next war isn't going to be a land war. It's going to be a nuclear war.
Yeah.
And it could be over pretty quick, and so could the lives of hundreds of millions of people.
Yeah.
We're not immune from this anymore.
No. And I think we've been fortunate that it's, as much as that can be in quotes, I guess, that these wars have all been fought away from American soil. But at some point,
but they're
that's
not.
Gonna...
It is, you're right. So I see this as an urgent moment.
Sure.
Now, you know, throughout my whole life, I've been able to break stereotypes. You know, I was elected at a very early age, one of the youngest people ever to serve in city council.
Yeah.
I was elected as the youngest person ever to be mayor of a big city.
Wow. Okay.
And now, years later, I'm running for Congress, again, breaking the stereotype. I'm at the top of my game.
I can feel that.
Not only,
I can hear it.
Not only in intellect, but in energy, in health, in a dedication to the people, in a willingness to serve. And you know, I wake up every day just ready to go, and I'm ready to do that in Washington. We have to start breaking the stereotypes. You know, stereotypical thinking just leads to us saying, well, you know, this guy's got a D in his name. I guess I got to vote for him. No, you don't.
Yeah.
This person has an R. I guess I have to vote for him. No. I'm always about breaking the mold, about finding, giving people an option that lets them explore the possibilities of what could be.
Yeah.
Think about it. One independent in Congress, in a divided Congress, the difference that could make, especially if that independent is someone like myself who has proven a willingness to challenge the status quo and is not afraid. Because, you know, if you have courage, you can make a majority. And so I'm ready to bring that to Congress with, you know, frankly, the lifetime of experience I had as a councilman, a clerk of courts, mayor of Cleveland, state senator, United States representative for 16 years. There's very few people in government who have that kind of background.
Sure.
And people who want to retire, that's great. A lot of people deserve to after a lifetime of service, but they can't because of the economy. For me, my service is just beginning.
I love that. I know we need to wrap it up. I want to ask you one just personal question to close this out, because I was surprised, actually. I always knew you were friends with my uncle growing up, but in your memoir that you wrote a few years ago, you wrote kind of beautifully about our whole family and praying the rosary with my grandmother and going to church with my dad and his siblings. Like, I didn't realize, I guess, how integrated you were into the family household. And it's only something I've ever known. The house on Lorraine was sold long before I was born. So I've only known it as like a drive past and, oh yeah, that's where I grew up. I'm just curious sort of your memory of my family and growing up, visiting that house and just anything that you recall about my grandparents or aunts and uncles.
Absolutely. 7014 Lorraine Avenue. That was the Rosella household.
Yep.
Where Juan Rosella, your grandfather, and Rosemary, your grandmother, would gather every evening to pray the rosary, along with thousands of others who were on a radio at the time where it was emanating from a priest, I think, in New York.
Yeah.
So they prayed the rosary every night. And before that, there was family dinner. Your grandfather was a master chef at one of the big hotels downtown.
Yeah.
And I have to say, you know, coming from a big family myself of seven, I think there were 13 siblings in the Rosella family.
Yeah, 12. But
12. I was the 13th, I
there
guess.
There you go.
And so it was great to eat there every night. I mean, the food was the best you could get.
Yeah.
Your grandfather was a genius as a cook, and he was a very humble man too. But the values of the family were something that, you know, I shared. I mean, I was part of that growing up and living off on, you know, on Lorraine Avenue. I lived right around the corner. And your uncle, Richard, and I were in the same class. You know, I'd often join the family at church on Sundays. In addition to being there throughout the week, it was like my second family, my second home. And it was very influential because of the deep spiritual ethic of a family is something that I carried with me. And Rich and I explored all of Cleveland together. And later on, we went to the same high school together at St. John Cantius. And later on, we both ended up working for the Wall Street Journal. And he made a career of it, and I kept moving into politics.
Yeah.
But your Uncle Richard's been a very important person in my life. I love him dearly. And I know, of course, your father and your uncles and aunts and some of your cousins. I mean, it's an extension of my own life. And I don't forget where I came from for a heartbeat, because I carry that with me as part of my expression. Who you see talking to you right now is basically an evolution of the same person who was there, you know, running around 73rd and Lorraine with the rest of the, with the Rosella family and others from the neighborhood, and we're going to school at St. Coleman's, St. John Cantius, that time that I shared with Richard and our lifelong voyage together as friends. Hey, all that is with me. That's who I am.
Yeah.
You know, we're the sums of all the people that we've met, but more specifically, the people who we grew up with and the people who have been part of our journey throughout our life. So I can tell you, you have a name that you can be very proud of, a family whose legacy is extraordinary, and it's one that I feel humbled and privileged starting back 50, 62 years ago, maybe. Yeah. That's how far back I go with the Rosella family.
Wow. Well, any of those words, all of those words would be very meaningful coming from anybody, I think. They are especially meaningful coming from you, Dennis, and just knowing what you have devoted your life to and your career. And as we've talked about in this conversation, really just being that truth teller and, you know, keeping people honest in Washington and helping people in the neighborhood, you know. I appreciate it, and I thank you for your time today. This has been a great conversation.
Thanks, Heath. And people want more information, please go to Kucinich.com. If you can help us in any way, it'd be much appreciated. We have a door-to-door campaign. We're interested in volunteers. You can sign up there, and if anybody wants to make a contribution in other ways, you can do that as well. Heath, let me tell you, the minute that I got a call to do an interview with you, I said yes instantly. That and why? Because of 7014 Lorraine Avenue, going back all those many years, you're an expression of that family in every way. So thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Dennis. All right, Dennis Kucinich there. A lot to take in, a lot to understand. We talked after the interview ended there for a few minutes, and one of the things that Dennis said to me that was just so, so meaningful is that he could hear my grandfather in my voice, which, as I said at the beginning, I never met him. He died about 20 years before I was born. I know he was born in the Philippines. I have no idea what he sounded like. I have no idea what his accent was like, how well he spoke English, how fluent his English was, how understandable he was. I have no idea anything about him, really, beyond a couple of stories. And just to hear that Dennis, somebody who was in that house, somebody that knew my relatives personally, knew my grandfather personally, and could see this flashback to something, you know, 50 years ago and be like, oh my God, that's Juan right there in me. It was trippy. It was heavy. I've never heard that before from anybody. I've never gotten that before. And it's just kind of strange how somebody can be gone for that long and for the mystery of that person to still be unraveling and discovering new information and just reframing everything. Just for me, thinking about who I am and, you know, that my grandfather is carried around with me and he's this person I didn't know. It was a lot. But anyways, I appreciated Dennis's perspective. I'm glad he was on the show. I'm glad we had a chance to talk about Gaza in particular. And again, 90% of the time we are aligned. There is this question of Israel. Maybe I'll have him back and ask him what he meant there. Maybe his mind changes between now and then. Maybe my mind changes. Probably not. I don't know. But if you'd asked me 6 months ago how I felt, I don't know that I would have the same understanding that I do today. It takes work, it takes practice, it takes reading and knowledge and listening and talking to people. And that's what this podcast is about. As a reminder, I publish my newsletter every Wednesday and every Sunday. Go to heathrasala.com/newsletter to get on the list there. And again, I'll just mention, if you feel like you are getting something out of this show, if you are learning something, if you feel like you are a different person because of these little podcast episodes, please consider a paying subscription. It helps support the work that I do here, and I really appreciate it. I'm at Heath Rasala on social media. Give me a follow and leave a review on your favorite podcast app as well. I love hearing from you. I will talk to you in 2 weeks. Until then, stay safe.